I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Who needs an alarm in the morning when McDonald's has sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles and a breakfast cutoff? Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to the Wagon Wheel. I am Jared Kimber, and this is the cricket podcast where we talk about cricket, but from your questions is what I meant. Remember to go over to goodareas.co and subscribe and get involved with all the extra content that we talk about. But this one, it's as simple as this. If you want to ask questions, go to patreon.com/Jared Kimber, and you can sign up there and you can ask questions beforehand, like a lot of people have today. Or if you are more of a YouTube person, remember to hang around for when we do the lives. I usually do them about this time on a Tuesday, if we're being honest, but I make no promises at any stage about what time I will be available or when I'll be on air. But yeah, so I'm usually on air around this time on a Tuesday, and if you ever want to do a super chat, you can. And if you want to put chats or normal chats or super chats or anything else in there, please do and bring them on over. But let's get to the main part of the show, which is the questions. As I said, we've got a lot to do today. So Ali says, do you think the IPL owners will still risk government patronage and their real money-making businesses by going against the interests of the BCCI? Yes. I think the kinds of people that we're talking about who own these teams, and it's not every owner, but I think in general those owners are so popular as a group that, yeah, occasionally they will go against what the government wants to do in certain things. That's what billionaires can do, and there's a couple of billionaires in that list, right? So I've got no issues with them going their own way. I'm not sure what your full kind of context of this is, but I've heard of people saying things like, you know, what if they want to have Pakistani players in, right? If the owners wanted Pakistani players in and thought they could make more money from having Pakistani players in, they wouldn't make more money, and so it wouldn't work necessarily, at least in the short term, being able to do that. But if one day the best cricketer in the world, if I don't know. There is a version of Asif Ali who bowls like Shaheen Afridi, then maybe things will change a little bit if that's the most marketable player in the world or whatever that may be. But, you know, and there'll be a few different things with the IPL owners that will go against, you know, government advice and things like that. I don't think they're going to worry about that. They're going to worry about bottom lines. And so it's not going to be whether it bothers the government or it doesn't bother the government. It's going to be, is this going to cost us money in the future, would be my guess, is how they would work. Certainly how I would be suggesting they do their things. Ben says, are clutch player stats a thing in cricket, or do we remember good players doing good things in big moments? I know my light went off there. And we forget the times they don't win a game from winnable position. And if they are a thing, how do we use stats to track them and analyze them? How much value would a player who's elite in the clutch but average the rest of the time have against the opposite? So we don't, I don't know of anyone who tracks these stats, and I'd be very, very not worried is the wrong way of putting it, but I'd be very skeptical of anyone who keeps these stats, because firstly, you have to define what clutch is. You know, we talk a lot on this channel about coin toss games. And sometimes I will say a game is a coin toss, and then later I'll think about it and go, oh, yeah, they won in the last over, but it wasn't really a coin toss, was it? You know, they had that situation of in hand, but it looks close on the scoreboard. Or, you know, one team will come back from nowhere and they'll end up like 7 runs short or 6 runs short, but actually a lot of those runs were scored after. So even then, like, the final result doesn't always give you the best example of how close a game was or how close a game isn't, right? And I think, you know, you go through all these sorts of things when it comes to players all the time, right? And how you want to focus on this. Your first point, Ben, which was, where is it now? Do we remember good players doing good things in big moments and forget the times they don't win a game from a winnable position? We also quite often forget the times that they played really, really good and in losing positions, right? And the overall point I would always make when someone says, you know, this player's clutch and this player's not clutch, there's a lot of guys like Kieran Pollard, Michael Bevan, James Faulkner, MS Dhoni, David Miller. Name your favorite chaser, and I will tell you about a middle order player who's really good batting in the second innings. Right? If you're a middle order player who's better in the first innings, you might win as many games, but it's not going to look like that. I'm a Denver Nuggets fan, as everyone knows. Jamal Murray has hit 2 clutch shots to beat the Lakers of recent times. We all know he's probably at best a 45% chance to hit those shots. That's probably what his normal rate is for shots like that, right? Maybe even lower than that. But he happens to hit 2 in a row, so now he's a clutch player. I've seen Jamal Murray miss many shots that could have won games for the Nuggets, the same as Nikola Jokic, right? The truth is they're going to have the ball in their hand at the end of the game. And because of that, they are both tough shot makers. Well, if they're going to have the ball in their hands at the end of the game and they're tough shot makers, then chances are they are going to hit game winners, right? If they're a player who isn't a tough shot maker, because that isn't, they're brilliant at everything else, but they're not a tough shot maker, are they not going to be clutch? Because they're not going to get the ball in their hand, it's going to go to someone else. And so the way that we think about these things is ultimately flawed. And I think that's the best way of looking at it. And I just want to you look at MS Dhoni for a moment when it comes to having a look at him in chases. Let's have a look at one day cricket, I think is the most interesting one here. So if you look at chases in one day cricket, and we'll look at the second innings, and we'll look at batting here, right? So overall, in the second innings of batting, we know that he averages, where are we? A little bit higher in the second innings than it does in the first innings. So I think he averages high 40s in the first innings overall and low 50s in the second innings. But in the first innings, he scores a lot quicker, right? That's the first thing to remember. So he's purposely slowing down so he can get to the end of those games. And then if you look at match won and match lost, which is a really, really important thing on those sorts of things. So despite the fact that he is averaging a lot more in these sorts of games, they've won 116 games where he's batted in the second innings, and he has averaged 102 in wins in ODI cricket when chasing. Not out merchant, absolutely brilliant. It goes on usually to have quite a high strike rate. Do you want to know what MS Dhoni averages in losses? Right? He averages 28 at a strike rate of 71, right? Now, he was absolutely perfectly suited to that role. He took what Michael Bevan had done and I think did it even better. But the truth is that we don't look at all that sort of stuff when we're looking at it. I do think there is an element of certain players who get better with certain motivations or in certain situations, right? And so you look at someone like Kevin O'Brien, and the Irish players will say, when the lights are shining, he's probably going to be a better player than he is going to be, you know, playing a one-day game in Namibia with 12 people in the crowd. Sorry, but do you really have to do that now? Apparently you do. So I do think that that's just a part of it. right? There are players who get motivated a little bit more like that, and you do see players rise. And there are many big game players that will do that. But MS Dhoni would be able to help you in a chase in any particular situation because he had the skill sets and the game and the brain that would help him in those situations, right? So does that make him a clutch player, or does it make him a player perfect for those situations, right? MS Dhoni was a great player in the first innings when there wasn't as much pressure on. He averaged almost 50 with a strike rate of 88. And yet, that is not how we remember him. So we have ignored his first innings, and we've ignored the 67 times he batted in the second innings, and India lost, and he was terrible, right? Josh says, last week in Wagon Wheel asked about my dream Test 11's fielding capabilities. Many of whom also appearing on a Crick Picks episode. That is, I really like that episode, actually. It's one of my favorite. This week, I'm curious about what is perhaps the team's biggest weakness. The lack of an elite first change. Joel Garner. How much does missing Joel Garner hurt my team? I think your team's really good, Josh, but I think you could probably come up with a team that would beat it, is the best way of answering your team. me and Bumble are doing a project at the moment, and one of the things that we're doing is trying to come up with our dream 11s. It'll be up on TalkSport soon. And we have to agree as selectors on what we want and what we don't want. And the one thing that we have kind of worked out is that we want attacking openers. And especially Bumble wants attacking openers. And he wants attacking openers because they change the game really, really quickly. But also, if you have Sobers and Imran Khan and you know, whoever else you want, Callis and all these different players in your side, and they're all, your batting's going to be stacked to like number 6, 7, or 8 if you want it to be. You can actually get away with attacking openers rather than Gavaskar and Boycott, even if Gavaskar and Boycott and Cook might be better options, right? And it's a bit the same with your lineup. If you have two of the greatest opening bowlers of all time, your first change bowler doesn't have to be Joel Garner. And so when you are putting sides together, another thing that we looked at with this team is we know that Sobers is going to make out both of our all-time 11s. I think Bumble thinks he's the best cricketer he ever saw, and he would certainly make any 11 that I would ever make, which means we know that we have 7 batters and 5 bowlers to begin with. We could pick a specialist wicketkeeper, right? We don't have to pick another all-rounder if we don't want to. Like, there's so much flexibility that gives you, and your team, Josh, from what I remember of it, is similar again, right? You don't have to have a great first change bowler because you have so many good spin options available to you, and you're going to have opening bowlers as well. Ruja says, the 2013 IPL final between Chennai and Mumbai had Pollard dragging Mumbai to 148 in the first innings and Chennai making only 125 in the chase. Mumbai reduced them to 39 for 6 at 7.3 overs, and Dhoni was heavily criticised for his captaincy and choice of batting when he didn't come out till number 7, and he promoted Bravo and Jadeja ahead of him in the thinking. Oh my God, is there more to that question that we've missed? Just when Muku was really, really confident that he'd nailed all the questions, we have missed that. Let me just go back and find that. I'm trying to think. I do remember that game. I don't know if I remember it as clearly as you do, Rudra, but I do remember that game. It also, isn't it just hilarious to see a game where a team made, what did they make? You say 148, and they would have been seen as a very good chance of coming home and winning that game with 148. And 148 now had, what were they? Like a 1.5% chance, according to the bookies, to win that game. Delhi the other day when they made 158, was it? Crazy. Ahead of him, when they're thinking that Dhoni would be better so coming in as a closer in the middle of the innings. Do you think this decision to come in later was fair enough? Or should he have come in against the newer ball after a couple of wickets fell? So this is a perfect example of why what he was trying to do is use two other guys with batting talent to go up the order and stretch out the batting so that Dhoni could come in a position of strength. If Dhoni goes in early, it's a position of weakness. But what if I said, Rudra, that there is no wrong answers here? Because if Dhoni came up the order, he might have ended up on 70 not out and they win that game. He might have also gone up the order early on when they were losing all those wickets and been one of those wickets. Then you don't have any chance of the chase. So when you're making all these sorts of decisions, we can all sit back and say that this is wrong and this is what they should have done and everything else. But the truth is that that's not really how these things work, right? And in Dhoni's case, he had massively convinced himself that he had a position that he needed to come in the innings. And we saw it again and again that he would do that for the team and put himself in the best possible position. If you were going to have a problem with some of Dhoni's, especially with a batting order, he could be a little bit, he had one good idea and we would go with it. Whereas if you watch him in the field as a captain, he would experiment a little bit more and try multiple different options until he found the thing that worked. He had a method that worked and he went for it and it didn't work in this particular game. Do we hold that against someone who has been consistently good every other time? And also, there's so much myth about the Dhoni captaincy. He made plenty of bad decisions. Repeatedly made bad decisions. Every captain does. It's impossible not to. And so I'm sure there are many times that Dhoni made a mistake. And this is just one that you remember. To go back to the clutch point that we had a moment ago. Ian says, what is the lowest number of families you could use to create a competitive Test 11? Oh, so you can pick multiple Pollocks, Muhammad Brothers, Wars. So this does depend on your family and also on gender. Because if I'm doing it on multi-levels of family, you could have three chapels or four chapels if you wanted. Right? Well, not all. Vic Richardson and then the three Chapel brothers would fill out a pretty good team. Even if you didn't use all of them, you might have Trevor as your 12th man in that side. But that, you know, but are we going back to grandfathers? Like, how far do we go back? You know, you get a couple of Comptons. Kind of get the name out. You know, do we go all the way back with that? What do we do with the Headley family as well? So it's quite interesting. If you just want to do a international quality team the quickest, I would say the Joyce family would be the quickest. What if they had five or six internationals that were all brothers and sisters? I don't think there was a father and uncle or a auntie or mother or anything in that off the top of my head. There must be some really good New Zealand ones as well. I'm trying to think of a three-generation family in New Zealand if you wanted to go that way. Who is is Amelia Kerr got a really good player in her family? I'm trying to remember who she's related to. Where's Amelia Kerr here? Yeah, Amelia Kerr. Yeah, so Bruce Murray. And I think they've got some other relatives. What about if you put the Bracewell family, the Joyce family, and what else would you have in there? The Muhammad family or the Chapel family? Would you not be able to put in an entire 11? Would you be missing some bowlers? So who's a family with two bowlers? Morkels? Is there another family? Oh, the Pollocks. Yeah, let's go back. So if you had the Pollocks, the Joyce family, and the Bracewell family, you have spinning, batting, bowling, all-rounders, top order, middle order. I think you've got everything. I'm not an expert on the entire Joyce family, but I think with those three families, you could put together an 11 of pretty high-end cricketers. I mean, I don't know how all the Joyce brothers were, but the Joyce sisters were obviously pretty good and Ed Joyce was pretty good. But if you're like, oh, we don't want to do the Joyce family, then you need another family of batters. So that's when you could get the two Chapels Victor Richardson would be another good one for that one. And then you got Muhammad brothers if you needed them. And if they got a cousin as well. No, actually, cousins may be stretching it a little bit here. But yeah, so I think you could make an 11 with three families that would pretty much tick every box. Now, you said competitive Test 11. I don't know about that, but you would have spinners, quicks, all-rounders, top-order batters, and middle-order batters off the top of my head. That's pretty good, isn't it? All right, let's have a quick break here on the Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back in a moment with more of this. Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are analysing every part of our game. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts, and articles on what is really happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket8.com is your place for cricket intelligence.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you, Tremfya, guselkumab, is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue, as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. Aditya says, if you were to create a list of the top 20 cricketers of all time, would Kapil and Botham be able to break through? Also, apart from Sobers, Kelce and Imran, who would be other all-rounders in the 20? It's hard for me to answer a question like that, Aditya, because I can give you like a very basic answer off the top of my head, but clearly I would have to go far deeper in to do it. I think if you're being honest, I don't think Kapil Dev or Ian Botham make that list of the top 20 cricketers of all time. I think if Botham had stayed professional, he probably does. I think Kapil Dev just falls short. And also, you can have Richard Hadlee, who's obviously a much better bowler than both of them, and while not the level of batter as they are, but certainly a very good quality batter as well. You know, a great number eight, right? So you can get some of that back. So I would have thought they probably don't make that list. Who'd be the other all-rounders? Keith Miller comes to mind. But Keith Miller doesn't really have a full career, does he? Because he misses a couple of early years because of World War II. So what does he play? 55 tests. It doesn't even take 200 wickets, does it? It's hard. I mean, Keith Miller had a bowling average of 23 and a batting average of 37. And by all reports, the batting average was largely because he didn't try very hard. And in first-class cricket, he averaged 49. So we know that he could certainly do that. So Keith Miller, but there are some other players with just longer careers. You've got Sobers, Kelce and Imran. What are the views on Gilchrist? I'm always interested when we talk about all-rounders, we don't mention Gilchrist or Les Ames. Those are two very, very interesting cricketers. You can throw Andy Flower in there as well if you want. There's a couple of very, very interesting cricketers when it comes to all-rounders who are wicket-keepers. And so once you start going down that track, it gets very, very interesting. But yeah, I've never done a top 20 cricketers of all time. I'm doing my book, obviously, on the best batters of all time. I will then probably do a book on the best bowlers of all time. If I sell any copies of the first one. And we would probably then try and go through the best cricketers of all time as well. Although I may know that, that one might be a step away, but it is a possibility. Jessica says, by what metrics can we assess part-time bowlers who performed important roles in the team but have awful career stats? Carl Hooper, Viv Richards, Ganguly, Solker. I kind of think as a part-timer, you need to be... Piss off. Dude, kick off. Thank you. That was unnecessary. All right, I'm going to lean forward for a second. I kind of think when we're talking about when we're talking about these part-time bowlers that you're talking about there, Jessica, what we need to look at is what was their workload, right? Because, so Viv Richards, for instance, bowled 5.5 overs per game in one-day cricket. That's a really big workload. So you know he's really being worked quite hard. And so there's a big difference between that and say, I don't know, I want to say Vrinda Sehwag might be someone who probably is a part-timer, but is a genuine part-timer. And probably when Vrinda Sehwag was bowling, there were only ever going to be two things going on. The vast majority of times it was probably either going to be spinning a lot or the game was almost gone, right? So I just want to have a look at his record just quickly here. So what did he bowl? He bowled about 4,300 balls in 251 games. Yeah, so he bowls 3 overs a game. So there's a big difference between the two. So I would look at usage, because if you have the ability to bowl that often and stay in the attack, there's clearly you're not an absolute donkey. Kyle Hooper is a perfect example of this. Kyle Hooper was a really interesting bowler because, a bit like Joe Root, he kind of looked like he could be a frontline bowler, but he never really took all that many wickets. You might have a similar thing to say about someone like Sehwag as well, but Sehwag didn't bowl as much as Kyle Hooper. So usage would be one of the things, especially if they have a poor record, but they still bowled a lot. I think that tells you that they were useful, if nothing else. And the other two things I look for in part-time bowlers is, are they good at one particular thing, right? So I can't remember who it was, but there was a player I was looking at recently, and it's in one of the videos we did, Jessica, where we talk about his economy rate. And he had a really, really low economy rate when he bowled. Actually, let's go to Shane Watson. Shane Watson's a perfect example of this. Late career Shane Watson couldn't really take bunches of wickets anymore. He'd slowed down so much. He couldn't bowl big spells, but he could bowl 1 for 16 off 8, right? Type of spells. And he could bowl, you know, none for 10 off 12 type spells. And the ability to not take any wickets but not go for any runs and keep the game in a similar position than it was before is massive. That's a really important thing as a part-time bowler. Now, Shane Watson's a bit better than that. But you either want your part-time bowler to be someone who can break through enough that it's worth giving them the ball, or you want them to not be able to go for any runs. If they could do the other two things together, then they're not a part-time bowler, they're a frontline bowler anyway. But one of those skills is quite handy. But the other thing is availability what I was saying before, the ability to just keep yourself on are really, really important. Bloody says, 2012 was the last time that India and Pakistan were in different groups for a T20 World Cup. What is the official state propaganda explanation by the ICC? Luck of the draw, or do they rig groups for other countries' matchups? I think they've been pretty honest. I mean, I don't know how loud they've ever said it, but certainly privately they're really honest and they're like, yeah, we want to make sure they play each other in every single tournament. And Australia and England, I think, play each other in most tournaments as well, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think these are accidents. Those are two of the, you know, best games from a media and social media point of view. I mean, the India-Pakistan's huge, but Australia-England is still quite a decent game. And certainly helps the profile of the tournament, even if it's not like a billion people watching, it's certainly getting to the point of like a lot of different people watching it. So yeah, I think they're pretty clear. It's why when people are like, you know, you're always searching, you know, we're going to search for corruption in cricket. The corruption is in the fact they rigged the World Cup draw. It's right there. There should be, the draws in sport should be completely independent and should be completely fair, and they're not. Right, it's nonsense, and I don't understand it. If that's all this tournament is at the moment, and we have so many of them, if it's just to get India and Pakistan to play, I mean, there's an issue with our sport. Let's have a quick break, and there's many issues with our sport, and then we'll be back in a moment for more on Wagon Wheel.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome back. I'm Jared Kimber, and this is Wagon Wheel. James says, are there any laws against anatomy? Specifically thinking of bowlers with over 15 degree of hyperextension in their elbow joints. What advantages could that give a bowler? Well, bowlers do have hyperextension. And so that is actually now, there's no law against that because we understand it. And it was something that we didn't understand at the time that those, the original cricket laws were made. Yeah, there is no particular laws against that kind of thing. I suppose you could you not make an argument that there are certain people who can't raise their arm above waist high or whatever. I can't remember what the actual law is. You can make an argument if you can't bowl above, is it shoulder high? Yeah, it's shoulder high, isn't it? If you can't bowl above shoulder high, you'll... it's not legal, but there are people who just can't lift their arm above that height. And we're now seeing, you know, spinners trying it and, you know, Pathirana and Tushara and obviously Malinga back in the day. There's a law. That would be a law. I'm trying to think if there's anything in batting. I can't think of anything specifically. Yeah, but so hyperextension is now understood. And I believe, and I'd have to go through the conditions on throwing, but I believe hyperextension is now understood enough so that there is not, it's just a natural advantage for bowlers who can do it. But they're trying to stop the extension before the hyperextension. I think that's right, unless I've just remembered it all. Bloody Bugger says, historically, why didn't players from subcontinents go overseas and play counter cricket Sheffield Shield? Although there are exceptions like Farooq Engineer, their numbers years played are less compared to the West Indies players. There was more money in subcontinental cricket than there was in the West Indies, if you want the real reason. I don't know if the summers might have played a part as well when your summer was. When Ranji Trophy was traditionally played. Oh God, I'd have to look at the old Ranji Trophy. Trophy fixtures, 65 is a good year, isn't it? Ranji Trophy in 1965. Let's see what I can find here. Central zone matches. No, I figured it would be over the Christmas period. It doesn't look like it was that. There was a lot of Pakistan players though, wasn't there? I think it's more an Indian thing than a Pakistani thing. I could be wrong, but yeah, a lot of it is money. So if you look at a lot of those players, the Asian players, they would be paid to play cricket in India. Not necessarily they made their money through first class cricket, and not necessarily they made their money through the international team. You're going to get kicked out. I hope you understand that. I just realized that people on YouTube will understand a cat is attacking me. People on the podcast will not. I have a cat attacking me for no reason. There wasn't really a lot of money to play any level of cricket. Whereas, you know, if you're in India, you might get paid money to play for an office side or a ringer side, all these different things. And there was probably more money in Indian cricket for that than there was even in Pakistan cricket. But yeah, there's lots of Pakistani players who played county cricket. So certainly I don't think there was anything like that. Also, West Indies were a better and more famous side in the 60s, 70s and 80s than India and Pakistan were, right? So it would make sense. If you go back, there aren't a lot of New Zealand players who played at that time. You know, if you go through it from that perspective, again, it makes sense. West Indies were, well, once South Africa go out, so from 1970 certainly till, what, 2000, West Indian players are thought to be in the, you know, in one of the best two sides in the world for big periods of time. That isn't the case for the Indian side, the New Zealand side, the Sri Lankan side, Pakistani side, and everyone else. So I think that also plays a part. And then it's also, there was probably a, so the early belief was that the Indian players really struggled with faster bowling and seam bowling specifically. And so there's probably a bias against Indian batters would be my guess. And I'm just guessing there. The other thing that I would have thought is that the Pakistani players would have been seen as more used to fast bowling and seam bowling because that was a steadier diet that they got in Pakistan. And so maybe that was seen as slightly different. Yeah, so those are the main reasons. But yeah, if you go back, what, Hadley, Glenn Turner, before, what, 1985, John Wright at Derby, I think, there really weren't many New Zealanders. Like Glenn Turner and Richard Hadley, really the pioneers of that as well. And then you have it. And then you also mentioned Sheffield Shield cricket. So Sheffield Shield doesn't have many international players, and generally they tended to be the best player in the world. So the only kind of players that would have gone in at that stage would have been probably Gavaskar and Kapil Dev. My guess is that those guys would have made more money from all the sorts of things associated with cricket rather than coming out and playing Sheffield Shield cricket. Gavaskar may not have suited the Australian mindset when it comes to, you know, more slightly more attacking openers. Kapil Dev would have been a fantastic player, but not all states had overseas players in Sheffield Shield cricket. So I don't know if there's overseas signings in Sheffield. It really wasn't that big a thing. It wasn't something that we saw all the way through so I'm thinking of, let's see who we have. How come Canada? Oh, okay. That's exactly the wrong thing I wanted to see. But yeah, so it wasn't ever a thing that really happened, and there wasn't as much money. So quite often there would be a secondary reason why there was a player who was playing in Shield cricket. And it might be to do with their fame or, you know, or a local person going all the way through. I can't see it now, but Wes Hall, Joel Garner, Barry Richards, Andy Flower would be one of the most recent ones. Yunus Khan, trying to think of any others. Imran Khan. There's probably like a bunch more that I can't think of at the top of my head, but there isn't like hundreds of them. And so if you think about the players I've just said there, right, they're all pretty high up. And during that period when there might have been Indian players going to play in Sheffield Shield cricket, it probably there wasn't as many great Indian players who were automatic selections at that time. And the Gavaskar one doesn't quite fit. And I would have assumed that with Kapil Dev, he would have been a chance. But, you know, Ian Botham didn't play Shield cricket either, right? Yeah, that's right. So there was a lot of, you know, great cricketers who didn't. So it did fade out a little bit more in the 80s, which is maybe when, maybe it didn't. Yeah, it's a tough one, but there's some really interesting ones too. I've talked about all the great players. Vic Marks is one who probably you could have got someone from India because he played for Western Australia for quite a while. Anyway, it's a really fascinating question. Jessica says, what do you think separates the test great all-rounders with the myriad of all-rounders who are high success in ODIs but never made it in tests? Abdul Razak, Chris Harris, Dwayne Bravo, Simon O'Donnell. Strike ball. They didn't have a strike ball. Everyone you have just mentioned on that list is probably at their best a containing bowler outside of perhaps Abdul Razak. And Abdul Razak was probably too slow a bowler in to be successful in Test cricket. Let me just look at his Test average to see if he... So in Test cricket, he averaged 37 with 100 wickets. And my guess is that he probably did not bowl with the new ball all that often. And I think for him to be good, he would have probably had to bowl with a new ball. Yeah, 9 times he took the new ball in Test cricket. Well, 14 innings in total in 9 Test matches. So all those guys you've mentioned, Chris Harris, you know, Dwayne Bravo, Simon O'Donnell, certainly all defensive bowlers and all great defensive bowlers, if we're being honest, and you should certainly respect them. But Simon O'Donnell, like I watched a lot of him play when I was young. He was the captain of Victoria. He wasn't a great red ball bowler. He was much better when people were coming at him very hard in ODI cricket. And he was a very clever player, very natural athlete. I've tried to interview him a bunch of times. Unfortunately, he never gets back to me. I would love to talk to him about his career because I think it is very fascinating. But you look at his first class bowling average and it's 37. Right. So it's the lack of the ability to strike. And he was a clever bowler oftentimes, but I he didn't quite have that level. And then you go to all the other guys that you've just mentioned there, and they're all the same. And then you go to their batting. None of them are, maybe with the exception of Chris Harris, are automatic top 6 batters in Test cricket. So O'Donnell, Razak, and Dwayne Bravo are probably all fantastic number 7s, but not quite good enough to be number 6s. And then you have, I would say, Harris probably underperformed in Test cricket with the bat. So he averages 45 in first class cricket and 20 in red ball cricket. In Test cricket. So he probably should have made more runs. He's the only one there that I would have said you could just about use him at number 6 with the bat. But I can't imagine that Chris Harris is going to be a better bowler than Carl Hooper or Joe Root, to have a throwback from what you said before. Let's have a look. What did he do in Test cricket? 16 wickets, an average of 73 in Test cricket. And in first class cricket, 160 wickets, an average of 35 from 131 games. So he averaged about a wicket a game. So his bowling is getting you very little. So if he wasn't batting at number 6 level, he wasn't getting you anything at all. And then the other guys that you mentioned, Abdul Razak, probably his batting wasn't quite, as I said, he's a number 7. Dwayne Bravo is a number 7. And Simon O'Donnell is probably a number 7. I wonder if O'Donnell could have been a number 6. Let me just have a look here. His batting record in Test cricket, he averaged 29. First class cricket, he averages 39. So if he was a slightly better bowler in first class cricket, you might have been able to say, okay, well, we get a really good fifth bowler here. And we get a slight discount on our batting, but he could still hold a bat and he still made 7 first class hundreds. But yeah, these are the reasons that they went on to be the sort of players they were, is that their skills are actually more suited to the other format. Mystic Referee says, What was it about Lara that he was full of attacking flair at the crease, but counterintuitively had the quality of making gigantic test scores? You come at this at a very good time. I spent about an hour talking to Jimmy Adams about Brian Lara the other day for my book. So you might have to go to the book for the full story. But Brian Lara was a player who was incredibly competitive. And when he took it to the other level, there was almost nothing that you could do to stop him unless the conditions were in your favor. So someone told Brett Lee, I think, talked about this. He said, if you're bowling to Sachin Tendulkar and you bowl the top of off stump 6 balls in a row, he will punch you to mid on 6 balls in a row. And the minute you bowl the top of middle stump, he might go, okay, well, this is the one I turn on the leg side and I take 2. Brian Lara, you bowl the ball the top of off stump 6 balls in a row and he hits you to backward point, cover, mid on, mid wicket, right? His ability to turn every single ball into an attack on you, even when he wasn't scoring, is a different level. And so Sachin Tendulkar was more technically correct and made more correct decisions in his career. But Brian Lara upset your rhythms as a bowler and really put it into a position of where you would completely run out of plans against him. Then once he started attacking, once he flipped it to that seventh gear that he had that almost no one else has ever had before. I was just watching the Danish Kaneria video the other day where Danish Kaneria says, well played, sir, when Lara for a millisecond doesn't pick his wrong end. And then Lara just goes 6-6-6-4 or something in the next four balls and just destroys him as a bowler, right? That level, that seventh level, he technically he was incredible. He was a brilliant attacker and he could hit the ball in any gaps. So when he is going and you watch, there's a game that Jimmy Adams told me to have a look at, I think it was at Edgbaston where he makes 100, where England just keeps setting up the offside field with like eight fielders on the offside and he keeps picking the gaps. So once Lara gets going, the ball is going to hit the middle of the bat. That's the same for Tendulkar or Barrington or Callis. All those guys are exactly the same as Lara. The difference is once the ball starts hitting the middle of his bat, you can't set a field. There is no field that you can set that will even pause him. And I think that was the level that Lara got to. And there's a lot more in the book about why Lara was so good at picking gaps and this game that he played as a kid with his brother and, you know, quite a few other things, that make those sorts of players go to that sort of level. But he needed the motivation to go to that level in a way that probably Barrington, Callis and Tendulkar didn't need. So everyone is slightly different. But once he got there, it is that ability, there is that ability to score so quickly because there is no field that you can set. And Graham Pollock is another player who the older guys have said is very similar. There wasn't a ball that once Graham Pollock got set. So early on, you could bowl to Graham Pollock's pads and you could stop him from scoring for just a little while. And I think you could bowl the bouncer and you could stop him hooking. But eventually you had to try and get him out. And that meant bowling at middle and off stump and outside. And then you couldn't set a field to stop him. And it's that kind of thing where players go to a different level. And you said, what are the chances of someone breaking the individual test and first-class high scores? Very high, because people are scoring at a faster rate. So I do think there's a chance of doing that. And personally, I think it would be absolutely brilliant if that happened and Brian Lara came out of retirement and gave it another go. Aditya says, do you think Rohit and Warner would break into the top 10 all-time batters list in ODIs? Again, Aditya, it's a great question. But can you imagine the amount of research I would have to do on that? I think Rohit, if he has another couple of years of playing like he did in that last World Cup, Rohit should be on that list. But coming into that World Cup, he had very similar numbers to Viv Richards, yet despite playing 40 years later. And I'm talking about average and strike rate. Now, Viv Richards is probably the greatest of all time, so maybe that is a harsh person to compare him to, but Rohit's strike rate wasn't as good as it should be. But we have seen when he wants to play at that level, go back to the Brian Lara analogy, he can be at that level. I think Warner has a fairly good shout as well. So I think both of them have good shouts, but I would have to go really, really deep through it. But off the top of my head, I would have thought yes. Thomas says, in a pod last week, you mentioned that as an analyst, you occasionally need to just say that someone was out of form. As an analyst, how do you determine the ethereal nature of form? It's not that much different than a coach. If you're being honest, the difference is that a coach is probably looking at their mindset, their feet, are things going in the right area? I am probably looking at their decision-making, their recent scores, I would probably factor in strike rate and average, but also you would go through the clips, right, of, oh yeah, they made 20 in this game, let's go have a look. Oh, okay, two of them were outside edges and one was an inside edge through their legs. Okay. We get that. That's not quite the same. So it's not all that much different to what a coach does. But I'm looking for, the same kind of results from different kinds of signs. But it's not an easy one, Thomas. But sometimes you just have to say, I don't think this is going to change. This person is playing like this and they're going to play like this for the next 2 weeks. And yes, in a week's time, all their form might come back. Do we have time to make that decision? Is usually how I would frame it. Cam says, what's your preference? A 2-test series, a 5-day test, or a 3-test series, a 4-day test? 3-test series, a 4-day test, if it's minimum 100 overs a day. Anytime. Sandip says, why is it so hard to hit sixes against Bumrah? He doesn't really give you a good length. He skids on. So his balls generally go a little bit lower than you think they're going to go. And then he has the ability, because of his action, to get inconsistent bounce. So you don't get that sort of Pat Cummins consistency of bounce from him. His Yorkers are almost impossible to get under compared to most people, partly because of his action and probably that little bit of extra pace because he's releasing the ball closer to you. But there are a few bowlers, Pathirana, Lasith Malinga. It's clear with them because they have the lower arm action. Bumrah doesn't quite have that, but he maybe gets a similar kind of impact off the pitch. And then you've got someone like Ishan Sharma, who's a much taller, who always goes for fours and never goes for sixes. So there are some bowlers who just do that naturally. I'm trying to think of other bowlers who go for lots of sixes, and there is someone. I think Pat Cummins is probably someone before this tournament anyway who was in that kind of thing. His best length ball is a slot ball. And I don't think if you look at Bumrah, even in a test match, he doesn't bowl slot balls. And so a slot ball can kind of just be hit from a length over mid-on or mid-wicket at any stage, right? If we're being honest. And that when Bumrah bowls a slot ball, it probably skids on a little bit more or takes off a little bit more because of that weird release he has.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
James says, mine was missed last week. Yeah, just on this, I should say, StreamYard does all sorts of weird things to us. Like last week, someone put in some super chats and everyone in the chat could see them. I think Varun was in there. He could see them. And they weren't on StreamYard. And StreamYard also eats your questions. And we've tried so many different methods to stop this from happening. So big apology to anyone who's ever put a super chat in, hasn't been read out, or someone who has put their question on Patreon. But it's just, unfortunately, we don't have the manpower to go back and check which ones are missed. Sometimes I will be flicking through the questions and afterwards I'll remember that something was missed, but I don't always remember them when we're broadcasting. James says, who would you pick, any past or present player, as a partner to enter a 2-on-2 backyard cricket tournament? Assume auto keeper and slips. I like that you went there. And what in your opinion is the best backyard cricket rule set? So I want Keith Miller, Garfield Sobers, Tony Gregg, Ian Botham. I think that would be my ideal setup because then I have guys who can slog it, which is what you want for backyard cricket. I have fast bowlers, and three of the guys I just picked have also bowled spin in test matches. And with Keith Miller, I don't think he needs to. So I'd probably go with that lineup. Ben Stokes would be another good one. Andrew Flintoff, especially if Ben Stokes is going to bowl spin. Sean Pollock, yeah, you don't want to face him in a backyard game. And I'm assuming here uneven things. So a spinner, I don't think, is as handy. But if anyone who's ever played enough backyard cricket will know that after a time, you start to churn up that surface and spinners do come into the game. You've got to think about this. Best backyard rules? Yeah, I like the ones where you don't have to run. I've always thought running in backyard cricket's pointless because you hit the ball off on the offside. And then I like to know you get 2 runs from there, you get 4 runs from here, you hit this, it's out. Automatic wiki, if you don't have, enough fielders, another perfect example. Automatic slip, I don't mind that. And as I said, having a few things out as fielding deterrents, all those sorts of things, I think work quite well. I'm not a big one hand, one bounce person. That's more for indoor cricket for me. James says, who's the biggest bunny, Reed, Whitney, or McGrath? I'm going to go Reed. I remember this one coming in, and I instantly thought Reed just because I didn't think he ever had the hand-eye coordination to bat. Whitney actually has okay hand-eye coordination. He just couldn't pick up the ball. I've never talked to him. I'm just assuming from watching him play. And McGrath eventually got better, right? Now, was McGrath a bigger bunny than the other two at one stage? Maybe he was a bigger bunny than Whitney. I don't think he was a bigger bunny than Reed. James says, if you're coaching a young express bowler, would you advise them to keep bowling the same way but focus on load management or get them to develop movement, slower balls and other variations that allow them to remain effective while not bowling at maximum effort all the time? Okay, so slower balls is maximum effort. I don't know how many people know about these sorts of things, but slow ball, and I know you don't just mean that, but it's very important that you know. It depends on if they're a young express bowler. I'm more than happy for them to get to the international game at 22, 23 just by being fast if they have one other skill. Maybe they can swing it on occasions. Maybe they can reverse swing it. Maybe they can wobble ball it. Maybe they have an off cutter, whatever that may be. They need one other skill. But the minute they get to that top level, I am working with them quite full on to make sure that they have multitude of arsenal available to them for two reasons. One, good luck playing that. Two, eventually they will slow down, right? You look at Nanti Haywood, right? You don't want to be Nanti Haywood. You want to be Pat Cummins. And there's a big difference between those two. But I mean, so Mark Wood, if Mark Wood loses his express speed, he's not going to play test cricket anymore, right? He doesn't do a single other thing at an elite level. Whereas Jofra Archer could bowl at 87 miles an hour and still be a really good bowler in test cricket, right? So that would be the thing that I would be teaching them or doing for them. Christopher says, how likely do you think private investment in the 100 will result in a longer tournament? I mean, if I was investing in it, I would want it to be a longer tournament. Surely they will want more than four home match days long term. This to me will be the unintended consequence of selling and be the final straw in the camel's back for traditionalists. Yeah, I don't think I disagree with any of that, if we're being honest. I think if I'm investing in the 100, I don't want it to be a short-term tournament. Now, the only thing I would say that sort of takes that back just a little bit is it fair to say, is it fair to look at it this way, which is, if the investment comes from the IPL teams, they don't want the 100 to be really long. They actually want the 100 to be like 2 or 3 months at most because the IPL is going to be really, really long. So that's where the investment is most likely to come from, right? And so if that is where the investment is most likely to come from, I would say that I am more than happy with going that in that direction at the moment. Because you would get the money without that. But it won't just be IPL owners, and there might be some other really important owners. There'll be some American investment, I would assume, as well. That's when it could get very, very messy. Matt 20 says, what characteristics would you pick in an English spinner if they didn't have the genius of Swan or Underwood? For example, would you be looking for a tall left armer that would bowl economically, so Ashley Giles, or something different? Also, which spinner on the county circuit would most closely resemble your criteria? It's a really interesting question, Matt. I'm trying to think if I have a good answer for it or not. So Ashley Giles is great because Ashley Giles can lock up an end and put enough pressure on top level batters that you can't just smash him. I think what you really want is someone who can bowl in England and can bowl outside of England. And so you're looking at that little baseball career arc of Jack Leach is a perfect example of that. You're looking at perhaps someone like Moeen Ali, who is still handy enough in England as away from England. I don't want that sort of defensive Ashley Giles spinner, only because that's not the kind of spinner I would pick in a side. But in county cricket, that's probably a fairly good player as well. So I am probably looking for someone who genuinely spins the ball, because I think on English pitches, especially in the middle of that summer, you need to be able to actually rag the ball to do anything. The other thing I would look for in English spinner is drift. So I'd be more interested in an English spinner having drift than I would be in most spinners around the world, because I think that you look at Swan I mean, you look at even Moinelli, and that ability to move the ball in the air is really, really important when bowling in England compared to other places, because you can't always beat them off the pitch. So you need to beat them in the air and off the pitch. Josh says, last week, we didn't have the team in before. Yeah, Gavaskar, Hayden, Ponting, Callis, Tendulkar, Sobers, Sangakkara, Imran, Jadeja, Ashwin, Hadley. So you would have, who would be your best first change bowler? Yeah, I see what you mean. Your first change bowler isn't great there, Josh. You know, there's no team that can't be improved by Joel Garner. Joel Garner was a great gully fielder, which is probably why you mentioned him as well. Adityan says, do you think there would be any merit in including wides bowled when a batter is on strike to a batter's tally of runs? Not in the official records, but to understand the impact of the batter. Yeah, a lot of analysts already do that. I've done that before. I think I've written a whole article about it. Chris Gayle, Andre Russell, these sorts of players usually have the most wides bowled to them. And it's twofold with those guys as well. Partly it's because they're great, but it's also because their weakness or their issue is when you keep the ball really, really wide away from them. You wouldn't bowl really, really wide consistently to Virat Kohli because he would just slash you to backward point all day and you'd be done. But yeah, it's something that modern statisticians and analysts are already looking at. So yes, you're right, and yes. Adityan again says, love the new episode on cricket picks on all format players. Kind of surprised Travis Head's name never came up. Him not getting included in the 15 is fine, but thought he would have at least featured in the list of honorary mentions. So someone said this, someone said something about this recently. You got to remember, it's actually easier to name most of the players when there's a small pool. We all assumed coming in that there would be a smaller pool. And then when we actually got in, we realized it was a much larger pool. And so our names are always going to be forgotten. But you're right, Travis Head, another very good. And in the next 2 years, that would, you know, he would probably automatically be in the 15. So it won't be an issue anymore. Adityan says, what is the difference between conventional movement off the seam and the wobble arm seam? Can you give a quick demo on the grip? I'm not great on the grip, but you have your fingers wider. What is different is when I'm trying to hit the seam, I'm bowling with my finger straight down and it's hitting the seam every time. And the seam is flattening in the middle. So you might even, if you're watching on the YouTube now, you'll be able to see how flat this seam is in the middle. The wobble ball is doing that and it's putting rotations on the ball that also means that the ball can react off the seam in slightly less predictable ways. There isn't a massive amount of difference between the wobble seam and the conventional seam, except for the fact that the wobble seam goes straight more often. And so you can't play for every ball to be coming back in. And the other thing is that the way that the ball is angled, so unless you bowl it absolutely dead straight, and it can go in either direction. So Curtly Ambrose is a perfect example of someone who did that. Generally, when the ball comes out, it will be angled in one way or the other, which means that the ball will go in one way or the other. So batters have signs. There's no signs with the wobble ball. And that it usually seems for longer because you don't hit the seam as much. So if you just keep hitting the seam over and over again, very soon it will just flatten out. Whereas if you're only hitting the seam every three balls, you're actually bowling two straight balls and one ball that seams. And that is more dangerous than bowling three balls that seam, right? Because once a batter realizes you can only seam the ball in one direction, they can start to play for that. And then eventually it will stop seaming. Samir says, a famous commentator tweeted this. I suspect we are witnessing a tectonic change in T20 cricket led by a group of relatively unheralded but completely uninhibited stroke players. The intensity of this change has caught a lot of people off guard. It is a learning curve for all of us in our understanding of the modern game. Yeah, it's been coming for a while. If you didn't think this was on its way, I don't know what you've been watching. I talked about it on the show with Bayram last night. Pretty much from the moment that England, from 2015 to 2019, this was coming because players worked out that they could score way quicker than they ever thought they could without losing their wickets. You then add baseball to that. Now you can do it in test cricket, T10 cricket, 100. What players can do when they have to go completely ballistic. Players now understand that they can score at rates never thought of before without losing their wickets. I think Phil Salt talked about it. All you're doing is really weighting it in your favor. When the ball is in this area, I'm going to hit this ball for 6. When the ball is in this area, I'm going to hit this ball for 4. And when the ball is in this area, I'm going to try and force it away for a single. that's what these players do, but they have lots of areas and they work on having more areas than players did in the past. It's a bit like the old Michael Jordan thing. There are all these TikTokers at the moment go, oh, Michael Jordan couldn't use his left hand. That's right. That's right. Most NBA players at that stage couldn't use their left hand. Most players in international cricket had one or two attacking shots, right? Now they have seven or eight attacking shots. And that's because of all the pioneers before them. The evolution of cricket is moving rapidly, right? And that is what we are currently seeing right before our eyes. I am conscious that the game has started, so I need to go. But I've got a couple of super chats that I wanted to get to. A big thanks to everyone in the comments today. But we had so many messages on the Patreon. Lenny says, who do you think can fill the shoes of Stark? Upcoming Aussie bowlers that you're excited about. And is the current Aussie bowling quartet the best in the world? Spencer Johnson, I still really rate. I don't think he's had a brilliant IPL, but I still believe in him. I want to see more of him bowling, but I'm a big fan of him. Is it the best quartet in the world? What is India? Ashwin, Bumrah, Shami, Jadeja. That would be one of those two, wouldn't it? Am I missing one? And what about South Africa? Yeah, I think it's slightly better than South Africa, and it's better than New Zealand. And it's certainly better than England at the moment. Yes, I think that's right, unless I'm missing some random team. Anish says, what is your take on Lawrence Booth's article? Do you think if the BCCI generates 80% of income, it is wrong for them to take 50% of the income generated? The BCCI doesn't generate 8% of the income. I didn't read Lawrence's article. But the BCCI doesn't generate 80% of the income. A love of cricket in India generates 80% of the income. The BCCI quite often slowed down. I mean, none of the major cricket boards can really take all that much credit for cricket being as big and as massive as it is, because they've all been run terribly. So the BCCI does not generate 80% of the income. Anish, I'm assuming you're an Indian in India. You generate 80% of the income. That is not a cricket board. So that's the first thing I would say. Second thing I would say is that for the main three boards, they already make money from their independent cricket, and they will always be the most wealthy boards no matter what. Why are they worrying about cutting up the international pie that could actually make the game better, which would help them make more money in the future? Because the more international teams that are stronger creates more rivalries, gets into bigger TV markets, maybe Brazil, maybe China, maybe Russia, maybe Germany, maybe the USA, whoever that may be, is going to make India, England, and Australia more money in the future. Right? And the best way to do that is to get more money and split it up more evenly. It is a bad business decision for those three boards to take a bigger chunk of the money if they want to make more money in the future, right? Why would you want to limit your market to begin with? Secondly, let's say that Indian fans make up 80% of the income, right? I'm actually okay with that number. No one's ever proved it to me, but I'm more than happy to say that that is correct, right? Indian fans have to watch the opposition teams. So that 80% is instantly down to 40% because India can't play themselves in those tournaments. So it doesn't even work the way that people say that it works, right? But the most important thing is, what are we doing here? This is the cricket board, or the three cricket boards that are the wealthiest are asking for more money when they are already completely sustainable and going ahead brilliantly while the rest of cricket is rotting on a vine. And the reason the World Cup is so brilliant is not just because of India, Australia, and England, right? Cricket has to grow. This is the pot that we can grow it from. And unfortunately, the people who run the game don't care about any of that. And if they did, they wouldn't make the vast number of shit decisions that they often make. Anyway, that's it for me today on The Wagon Wheel. Thanks to everyone for commenting. And as I said, really apologize that I couldn't get in there. Who we've got? Smith, Abdullah, Jessica was in there as well, Rahul, and everyone else in there as well. Thank you to Rodan, my cat, for absolutely causing all sorts of chaos all the way through the first part of that podcast. But thank you to everyone for listening, for watching, and everything else. And we will be back again very soon with more of this, because we do more of this. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku, as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.